This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire show to the excessive use of solitary confinement in Pennsylvania's correctional facilities. Akin to psychological torture, the numbers are staggering. On any given day in that state, approximately 3,000 are in solitary confinement. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In late July, the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights joined an amicus, or friend of the court brief, with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Generations Ahead, stating that DNA collection violates the Fourth Amendment. Under current federal law, felony arrestees are required to supply authorities with a DNA sample as a condition for bail. After the FBI receives the DNA samples and conducts an analysis, it places a profile into the national database CODIS. Individuals not convicted of a crime have to file a request if they want their information removed from the system, while the data collected without cause from other individuals remains there permanently. The Ninth Circuit affirmed the Federal DNA Fingerprint Act in the case of the United States of America versus Jerry Albert Poole, finding it constitutional to collect DNA from those, quote, arrested, facing charges, or convicted of federal offenses. U.S. District Court Judge Gregory Hollows said, quote, the court holds that after a judicial or grand jury determination of probable cause has been made for felony criminal charges against a defendant, no Fourth Amendment or other constitutional violation is caused. The amicus brief, filed with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, argues in part, quote, in this case, the government defends the warrantless, suspicionless search and seizure of a person's most private and personal information, his DNA. The government bears a heavy burden to show the collection and unending retention of DNA from a person merely arrested for a crime falls into one of the limited exceptions to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement. The government has not met its burden. Here on Law and Disorder, we've talked extensively about the erosion of the Fourth Amendment. The retention of DNA in this kind of instance is another example of this erosion. New York's Suffolk County is the most recent jurisdiction in the nation trying to bar specific gang members from so-called safety zones. Officials in Babylon, New York, are seeking what is known as a gang injunction along the lines of ones used in California and New Mexico. If granted, the injunction would block 37 members of the Bloods from gathering with other supposed gang members within a 2-square-mile area. The county must notify the identified individuals of this restriction. Those who wish to be removed from the list must notify the court and prove that they are no longer affiliated with a gang. Listeners may recall that a similar effort was tried in New York City in 2000 when police tried to prevent working women and alleged gang members from congregating in Queens Plaza. The ban was overturned in state Supreme Court, with the justice saying that the activities were not dangerous enough to curtail their civil liberties. In similar cases, National Lawyers Guild members in Oakland are fighting to prevent proposed injunctions that cover sweeping areas of that municipality. According to attorneys there, injunction zones become, quote, areas of virtual martial law, where police have unlimited discretion to stop named individuals and those who they mistake for their targets. Guild members are defending people who feel they have been wrongly included in these injunctions. Challenges have included disputes over the right to an attorney, the qualifications of so-called gang experts, the definition of an active gang member, and the role of local officials, such as city council members, in the making of public safety policy. Critics claim that this type of injunction is yet another veiled attempt at racial profiling. The Durban Plus 10 Coalition is accusing the UN Secretariat of sabotaging an upcoming high-level meeting on racism by upstaging it with a nuclear security summit scheduled on the same day. The coalition of non-governmental organizations includes the National Lawyers Guild, the U.S. Human Rights Network, and the National Black United Front. The high-level General Assembly meeting to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the Durban Declaration on Racism is scheduled for September 22nd, a decision taken by member states last December. But after the nuclear meltdown in Japan last March, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, on his own initiative, decided to hold a nuclear security summit during the upcoming General Assembly session, the same day as the high-level meeting on racism, triggering protests from the coalition of NGOs. The meeting on racism itself is mired in escalating political controversy, with Israel leading a campaign against it. In response, six countries, including the United States, as well as Canada, Italy, Israel, the Netherlands, and the Czech Republic, have indicated they will not participate in the meeting. Still, a majority of the 193 member states is expected to take an active role in the meeting, which will culminate in the adoption of a political declaration focusing on mobilizing political will to combat discrimination. In a statement, the coalition accuses these countries of trying, quote, to suppress the rights and demands of the many groups protected by the DTPA, including migrants, indigenous people, African and African descendant peoples for restitution and reparations, and those of the Palestinian people for self-determination. Earlier this year, the National Lawyers Guild called on Superintendent Louis Foligno to support the Program Review Board's recommendation to release Russell Maroon Schoetz into the general prison population at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Former Black Panther Russell Schoetz has been in prison since 1972, and the past 21 of those years have been spent in solitary confinement. He's 67 years old, his spirit is unbroken, and in addition to his record of good conduct, members of the Pennsylvania Prison Society who visit Mr. Schoetz regularly attest to his peaceful disposition. His daughter, Teresa Schoetz, joins us to talk more about his advocacy work and life as a political prisoner. Andre Jacobs is another Pennsylvania state prisoner in solitary confinement. Andre, a 27-year-old jailhouse lawyer, has been held in retaliatory solitary confinement for more than 10 years. In 2009, he was awarded $185,000 in a case against the Department of Corrections, an action that has resulted in his being singled out for abuse within the prison system. In January of this year, he was physically abused, issued death threats, and denied medical treatment. We will talk with Andre's grandmother, Liz Springer, about her grandson. Jerome Coffey is currently being held in Pennsylvania's SCI Forest. Jerome's social work while in prison has included sending clothes to villages in Uganda and to female prisoners in the Philippines. That work has helped label him in part as an instigator. He's been placed in solitary confinement for more than 8 years. Joining us now to talk about inmates in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania is Brett Grote, who works with the Human Rights Coalition. Welcome, Brett, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, great to be with you.
Brett, you're part of a group called the Human Rights Coalition in Pennsylvania. I came to learn about your work, having visited a couple of inmates on death row or in solitary confinement there. And it seems that you're one of the only groups advocating on behalf of individuals who've been kept in solitary confinement for long sentences. What does the Human Rights Coalition do?
Well, the Human Rights Coalition was founded by state prisoners in the state correctional institution in Green, Pennsylvania. In around the year 2000, the Pittsburgh chapter I work was founded in 2006-2007. The main mission of the Human Rights Coalition was to bring the voices that are most excluded from criminal justice discussions into that arena, namely those of prisoners, their family members, and affected communities. With that type of mission, it has led us to base our work upon building relationships with prisoners and trying to provide whatever support and advocacy possible for those who are being most impacted by the prison system. And that has led us straight into solitary confinements where people's lives are being micromanaged down to the most minute details.
There was some public attention a while back to the case of Russell Maroon Schoetz, who himself has spent, and this is incredible to me, over 20 years in solitary. Mm-hmm. How does the prison system justify that?
Well, the justifications shift from one day or one year to the next. It used to be based upon escapes that had occurred at this point almost 30 years ago, the last of them, in the early 80s was one, and then one in the 70s. Now, as he's approaching his 70th birthday, I believe he's 68, they're claiming that it's because of his past efforts at organizing hunger strikes, and they cite an incident where he was forced to defend himself against another prisoner. Again, we're going back over decades. He hasn't had misconducts for a long time. And they cite him being an organizer. He's been told that as an organizer, they don't want him in the prison. They don't want him talking to the younger prisoners and educating them in any way about their rights, about politics, about how to improve their lives.
And I'm sure they put it in terms of security issues.
Typically, the rationale that will be given in front of, say, the Program Review Committee, which reviews a prisoner's classification status, will be boilerplate security reasons. A prisoner is a threat to the safety and security of the institution. Now, in Maroon's case, he recently met with a prison mental health staff person because there was some movement towards releasing him from solitary confinement that ended up being blocked. But this staff person told him that in his file, unbeknownst to him, there was an allegation that he tried to organize an armed prison uprising or overthrow of the prison in the 80s. This has been following him around now for over 25 years in his file, but he has not been able to challenge this because he has not been informed of this at all.
Is he currently represented by legal counsel?
He is not represented by legal counsel. He brought a case challenging his confinement that was decided in 2000, and I think, based on my understanding of the law, it could be ripe for a new challenge based on the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment clause and the sheer duration of time that he has spent in solitary confinement.
Now, let's talk about that duration of time in his case and a couple of others that we're going to be talking about. And you mentioned that he met with a psychologist. We've discussed on Law and Disorder how solitary confinement really amounts to torture. And I personally don't understand how someone could even survive this more than a year with their mental faculties being in place. How does that issue of mental health and sort of torture factor into the work that you are doing?
It's central. It's very rare that we have somebody like Maroon or Jerome or Andre who are able to maintain their aura of humanity and resilience in the face of this. A lot more of our letters from solitary will deal with people who are in various states of psychological distress, plenty of suicidal thoughts, suicide efforts. The prison authorities' typical treatment for somebody who's in the restricted housing unit, as they call it in Pennsylvania, mental health treatment, is cursory interview at the cell maybe once every 30 days with a staff worker, which is to say that they're not really giving them effective mental health treatment. And if they have some sort of antagonistic relationship with the prisoner, which is pretty common when they're in solitary confinement, then they are less likely to get to any treatment whatsoever.
Tell us what a day in the life of solitary is like, Brett.
Not having been there, my experience is based upon our research, of course, but it's very monotonous. You spend 23 hours in the cell, maybe 24 if the guards don't take you to yard or shower, which they oftentimes won't and will find some sort of excuse not to. The things that one may witness on the whole are the constant screaming and yelling and banging and crying and cursing and talking to oneself by prisoners who are psychologically disturbed. That is an absolutely uniform pattern in all of the solitary confinement units throughout Pennsylvania. If a prisoner does not have outside support, which is common, that is able to send them in lots of things to read, things to stimulate their mind, then they are going to have very little to do. They're allowed out to the law library sparingly. If they're working on legal matters, too, then they're under the scrutiny, oftentimes, of staff who they may be filing complaints against or have reason to file complaints against. So there's that added threat. The witnessing of staff harassment, assaults, extreme racial brutality, and very explicit Klan-type racism is something that's also uniform in all of these solitary confinement units. On any given day, there's going to be some sort of constellation of these factors playing out. Unremitting monotony, the threat in reality of violence, and people literally losing their minds all around one.
Brett, approximately how many people in Pennsylvania are in solitary confinement, to your knowledge?
According to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections figures, the number could be between 2,500 and 3,000 on any given day. There are some units which I recognize are not in there. And, for instance, they have certain places called Secure Special Needs Units, which is solitary confinement for people with mental health diagnoses. But these are oftentimes just operated like solitary confinement units. Further, the death row units are all solitary confinement as well.
3,000 in one state. Do you know what the total population number is there?
The total population is 52,000 and rising. Pennsylvania is one of the leaders when it comes to continued prison expansion.
This is stunning. 3,000 in solitary confinement on any single day. Are there any legal challenges to the system that are being mounted?
Currently, the Human Rights Coalition does not have any attorney on staff, though we are constantly looking for serious and committed civil and human rights lawyers to work with us. We have a massive body of evidence about the patterns that are at play in Pennsylvania. The challenges that are being launched are being done by prisoners on a pro se basis to much detriment to themselves. And one of those is actually being waged by a young man, Andre Jacobs, who has been held in solitary confinement for 10 years. He actually won $185,000 in a prior lawsuit in which he represented himself against the Department of Corrections. And this current lawsuit he has deals with the string of retaliatory actions taken on him since he won that lawsuit while he's been in solitary confinement. He's named over 100 defendants from four prisons at that, and this is just covering the last 2 years of his confinement.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Andre, Brett, because we're going to be speaking with his grandmother, Liz Springer. I've had the pleasure of meeting with Jerome Coffey, who was being held at SCI Green and was transferred in the past year to SCI Forest, which is, I must say, an even more remote location for anyone wanting to visit. And I think we should note that these individuals rarely receive visitors, which adds to their plight in these correctional institutions. Can you briefly tell us about Jerome's background? He's a wonderful person and has been in solitary for over 5 years.
Well, in fact, Jerome's been in solitary for a decade. He's been in solitary for longer than that, since about 2000 to 2001. He was recently released in the general population at Forest, only for a few days before they put him back in solitary. And they are unwilling to provide him with the type of treatment or care or therapy that he would need to reintegrate back into the general prison population. Jerome has not had a misconduct for 10 years. I have seen this documented by the prison authority's own writing. They have not been able to provide and just won't provide any real rationale as to why he remains to be kept in solitary confinement. But Mr. Coffey has developed quite a reputation both inside and outside the walls as a very principled individual, somebody who stands for justice and for human rights inside of the prison system, and somebody who has, against all odds, maintained his aura of resistance amidst the most crushing of odds.
I've just got to say, and I'm tearing up here, because Jerome continues to write to me, and I am amazed at his spirit. He sent me a book recently. he exercises. And when I met with him, I was struck at almost, not an innocence, but it seems as though, despite everything he's been through, Brett, the system has not got the better of him. As I understand it, he was an aspiring boxer before he was arrested.
Yes.
And the conditions of his arrest, quite honestly, seemed very suspicious to me. We don't have time to go into it, but is that basically your understanding as well?
This is my understanding, and I'm beginning to learn more about his underlying conviction, which he has challenged from day one, and which people who I trust believe was wrongful, that he was set up. His not having his spirit broken by all of this is, I think, reflective of how he understands his own role within the prison system, within a much greater historical legacy of struggle against oppression and struggles for justice, which is manifest in the correspondence I've maintained with him for the past few years.
Are there any final comments that you'd like to make about this really deplorable and, I think, unforgiving system?
The solitary confinement system is an invisible system within the larger invisible system of the prisons. These policies of mass incarceration, race and class-based mass incarceration, are impossible to be carried out while respecting the human rights of the incarcerated. When it comes to the problems of overcrowding, when it comes to the various uprisings and disturbances that have happened in prisons as they've been packed to overflowing, the prison regime and the authorities have felt compelled to develop more repressive and extreme forms of control, and simultaneously they need to keep these buried and out of public eye because it flies in the face of everything the United States pretends to be as a champion for human rights and freedom and justice around the world.
Brett, this has been an eye-opener, and we hope to continue hearing updates on these men who are being really secreted away in unbearable conditions. Thank you so much for your good work on behalf of the Human Rights Coalition.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me, Heidi. It's been a pleasure.
Andre Jacobs is another Pennsylvania state prisoner in solitary confinement. We will talk with Andre's grandmother, Liz Springer, about her grandson. Welcome, Liz, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you.
I understand that your grandson, Andre Jacobs, has been in solitary confinement for over 10 years.
Yes.
And he was incarcerated at the age of 15?
Yes.
It's rather astounding to us that an individual could be held in those conditions for so long. How has he withstood this?
It's been pretty rough. It's been days, it's been times that I thought he wasn't even going to make it. I mean, seriously, it's been times that I thought I was going to get a call that he was dead. That's how bad it's been. And I think it's through, I mean, me trying to, you know, keep in touch and trying to do everything I can and supporting him, and sometimes I even send little inspiration cards or little notes and have a couple of friends that write him, and then I send him, tell him to read a couple, you know, Bible verses to kind of keep him strong. But there's been times that he's said to me, I can't do it no longer, I just can't do it. But somehow or another, he's been able to, I don't know how.
Now, we understand that he had a court case and actually was awarded a large sum of money in 2009.
Yes.
But that since then he's been singled out for abuse. Can you tell us a bit about that?
They've taken just about all the money from him. I think he's down to $75,000. They're trying to take that.
I see. And the case that he brought, was that for being in solitary or was it for his treatment in prison?
That was for something that I witnessed, that he lost the case. He went to court for, they was beating him in the courtroom. No, he went to case for something else, and he lost. And they said he had an attitude. And when he was leaving the courtroom, I witnessed them beating him because I said, I love you, Andre. And he turned around and said, I love you, too. and they started beating him because they said he wasn't supposed to speak to me. So they put him into the elevator and started beating him, and they didn't know I was running. I ran down behind them because they were so busy shuffling him into the elevator. They didn't know I was back there till I started screaming. You know, he lost that case and got the federal court because of that. He got 18 years because the guards got on stand and said that he did something to make, he hurt one of the guards' wrists. And so he ended up with like 18 years he got to do because of that.
So is how many more years remain in his sentence about?
Well, he only had 2 to 11.
He had 2 to 11?
Yes, 2 to 11, that's all he had.
Does he have legal counsel?
Well, when he go in, he have legal counsel. When he go in, the one he won, $185,000, he was his own legal. He was his own counsel.
Ah, he's a jailhouse lawyer.
Yeah, he won that case himself, but he wins some and lose some. And if he have a lawyer, yeah, at that time he had legal, because they had came to me and they had come to my home and they had said they was trying to take investigation and they was going to do this and do that to help Andre. They had me to come and stay all night. They told me not to say anything when I get on the stand except yes or no.
Right.
I was a key witness, see, but I was supposed to get on the stand and say yes or no, or either I was going to hurt his case. That's the one he lost.
How has this been as a grandmother? Has it taken a toll on you?
Oh, my God, yes, yes. Yes, it's been rough. It really has, yeah.
And does Andre get a lot of other visitors?
No, basically me. I just was up there last Thursday. A couple of times my son went with me because he went with me to drive. And then one time my granddaughter went. But usually I have to try to get somebody to take me up. I had a friend to take me up last Thursday.
Can you describe what it's like visiting him? You're not allowed to touch him, are you?
No, you're through a window. You're talking on the telephone, looking out a window. You're looking through a glass.
And when's the last time you had physical contact with your grandson?
Oh, probably 8, 9 years ago.
Hmm. How is his mental attitude? You said that you felt it was starting to show. Does Andre have hope that his conditions are going to get better and that he'll get out?
Here lately, yes. Lately, he has low hope, yes. I mean, up until maybe like 9 months. He's having a little hope, yeah, just a little. It's just heartbreaking. I mean, it's with me, it's like just me and here on the other side. And, you know, with the help of Brett and Vienna and Philadelphia, it's hard trying to get more help with the family, which hurts very, you know, his mom and dad. That hurts. Because I think if I had more support, we could do more for him and trying to get more people to go visit him. But, I mean, all he's been through, and I know he's telling the truth. I know because, like I said, I witnessed what they do to him. It has been times when it was so bad up in Pittsburgh. They would say to him, well, what you can't do anything because your grandmom can't do anything. What you going to do, call your grandmom? You know, they would come and harass him. And say, what you going to do, call your grandmom? What can your grandmom do? You know, that's the stuff he used to go to all the time when he was in Pittsburgh.
It's an inhumane system that we have, and it seems especially bad in the state of Pennsylvania. We are all sending, really, our hope to you and your family and thinking of Andre. And we on Law and Disorder will try to continue to draw attention to what I think is a particularly bad situation in Pennsylvania, and has been for many decades.
Well, did you hear about the time he was strapped in the chair for 12 hours, I think, without being able to move anything but his head?
No.
Yeah, that was in, which prison was this? Because they kept moving him like 3 prisons after that. I can't even think now, but it was like 3 months ago.
3 months ago, and they strapped him in a chair?
Yes, he was strapped in the chair, and the only thing he could move was his head for all night long. Didn't eat. He had to go to the bathroom. He just went in the chair. But, yeah, and I didn't know. Something kept telling me to go visit him. I couldn't understand. I said, I haven't heard from Andre in a couple weeks, and I usually hear once a week or twice a week. And something told me to go see Andre. When I went, they had just released him that same day from that chair. And when he told me what happened to him, I mean, my son was with me, and we both sit there crying. I said, Andre, how did you do it? He said, I just worked my head, my neck. He said, I would just work my neck back and forth, back and forth. He said, that's how I did it.
Was a complaint filed against the Department of Corrections?
Oh, Andre always filed, yes.
Right.
Done about it, but he always managed to file a complaint. But it's just, I mean, the stuff that they get away with, I can't believe what they get away with.
It's a secret system of really cruel and unusual treatment to individuals. I think we just have to continue to try to draw attention to it and to humanize the stories of people who undergo this abuse. We thank you so much, Liz, for being on with us. And
I thank you. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Former Black Panther Russell Schoetz has been in prison since 1972, and the past 21 of those years have been spent in solitary confinement. He's 67 years old, his spirit is unbroken, and in addition to his record of good conduct, members of the Pennsylvania Prison Society who visit Mr. Schoetz regularly attest to his peaceful disposition. His daughter, Teresa Schoetz, joins us to talk more about his advocacy work and life as a political prisoner. Welcome, Teresa, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Teresa, we've spoken about your father several times over the years on this program, and I just can't imagine how he has survived over 20 years in solitary confinement. What has that been like for you and your family?
Well, actually, although we've been going into the prisons for almost 39 years now, the solitary confinement has had the worst effect on us. Within the 39 years, we were able to have contact visits.
So
but
you
with
could...
the solitary confinement, the unit he's in now, there's no contact. You're behind a glass when you visit.
So you haven't touched him in over two decades.
No, and it's very emotional, and he's had grandchildren since that time, and he's never touched the grandchildren either.
How is he holding up? I can't imagine even a week in solitary, and for over two decades, does he still write you letters? How often do you see him about?
Oh, well, our family very much dedicated to visiting him every 3 months. But the important thing I want to make clear is that he's, by Russell Shokes being known throughout the country, he's been able to receive visits and mail from people all across the country. So that's constantly keeping his wheels spinning, meaning mentally his wheels are spinning. And we thank God for that, because there are inmates in a position like my dad, maybe not as long as my dad, but can't go a month without some type of contact from the outside world where they just mentally break down. I have noticed within the last year or so that his outlook on this thing about him getting out of solitary confinement is not as upbeat as it used to be, because he was like, I know the people going to free me. I'm not going to be in here. You know, he never thought it would come to this with 21 years. But I'm noticing now his conversations are really laid back. He's not upbeat as he used to be, and he is stressing on most of our weekly calls. He get one call a week, is that you got to get me out of here.
Have you or any of your family members or advocates talked to the prison authorities about his situation?
Oh yes.
And what do they say?
Okay, we just recently did a big campaign some months ago, and the New York Lawyer Guild signed on, American Freedom,
right.
Stating that this guy, 21 years with no infractions.
Because the Program Review Board recommended his release into general prison population.
Exactly. Camp Hill, the Secretary of Prisons in Pennsylvania, underneath the governor, when we talk about this prison administration, also said, you know, it's been years, he needs to be reevaluated. Stress that to the superintendent at my dad's prison. His name is Felino. I couldn't believe that everyone, the psychiatrist, everyone on the team, the secretary of prisons, were in daddy's favor to be released. But the superintendent has the last word. The superintendent saying daddy is a leader, and we have this on tape.
Meaning he would lead other inmates.
Right. And I spoke with the review committee board, the program review committee board, who sees daddy every 90 days to determine if he had any infractions, should we release him in the population. And he told me also, your dad is a leader. I said, no, he's a grandfather.
He's almost 70 years old.
Right. They still state that he's a leader. And then Felino, the superintendent, stated over 20 years ago, daddy had escaped from another prison and that we can't take that chance. Although we kick back with, you have a prisoner there right now in population who smuggled a gun into your prison. Right now, he's in population. He worked with a guard. He had a gun in his shoe. He was caught. But yet you still have him in population in your prison. And this all happened under your watch, Felino.
Teresa, do you think this has anything to do with your father's former Black Panther affiliation?
Of course. So I just been doing a lot of research at our main library here in Philadelphia. And when daddy was first arrested, man had escaped sometime later and was caught. One of the mayors of Philadelphia at that time, Frank Rizzo.
Yes, we know about Frank Rizzo.
Very much in a battle with the Panthers. And one day he just said, I'm going to get them all. I have this news article where he said, for every 10 Black Panthers, and I'll give you just two of my police officers, and we'll fight every 10 of you with just two for every 10. So it was like a war. The Panthers didn't just go in and say, hey, we want to battle the police. They said, hey, we want to educate our youth. We want to feed them. We want to take control of our community. But when it became war, when the Panthers were under attack, of course they said, we got to protect ourselves. That's what happened. And, of course, daddy is a political prisoner. He took a stand and stood on the front line for his people and his community. One time, let me tell you how uneducated I was. I said, I didn't know any better at this time. This was some years ago. I said, Daddy, why would you leave us? I had a little attitude with him. He said, I did it for my people. And how could I allow you to be raised in that type of system? And that's when it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, you can't be mad at this man. Not only was he helping his community, he was taking a stand for my life, for my children, for his grandchildren to come.
He is one of the most principled men, and I had the pleasure of meeting very briefly with him last year when I was at SCI Green. Mm-hmm. You know, that facility was a training ground, as it were, for some of the people who tortured at Abu Ghraib.
Right, Greener.
Yeah.
And Daddy, at that time, because not only was it at Green, it was at other prisons. In Pennsylvania, they were calling themselves the Wolf Pack, these guards, and they would roll one pants leg all the way up to the knee. So when you seen them coming, you knew they were part of the guards' Wolf Pack. They trained at SCI Green and other prisons throughout Pennsylvania, and then when the Armed Service called them, oh, my God, they were already prepared because they had already abused prisoners in Pennsylvania prisons.
Teresa, how have the guards treated your father?
Well, I can tell you, we had a problem with Officer Lynch and Officer Peters, and they were spitting in the food and tearing up family photos, and all kind of abuse was going on, beatings, unnecessary beating. And Daddy said, you got to do something. I said, Daddy, okay, I'm going to write the prison secretary tomorrow. He said, no, you got to go up there. And the next day I was on the Amtrak train. It took me about 3 weeks, and they were transferred.
You talked to the officials, and they transferred those guards?
Well, I went to, the prison officials where Daddy is at Green, they don't want to talk to me ever. So I went to the governor's office, the governor of Pennsylvania. Then I went to Camp Hill's secretary. So I was on trains back and forth. I went to the governor's office 3 times because, you know, 1 time don't mean anything. It's the same thing like when our people march nowadays and we march and we get in the street. You really just can't do 1 march. You really just got to keep going and going and going.
That's right.
Back. And same thing like what happened in Wisconsin. If you had to stay there at the Capitol, and I was prepared. I mean, I had even told my dad, I'm going to get a tent and set up in front of, he said, no, they may lock you up. I need you on the outside. He said, you know, you went up there already. I said, yeah, he said, you just got to keep going. And that's what I did. And the assistant warden went to Daddy's cell and said, Teresa has been really trying to start things with us. What do you want to do? He said, move me out of here. Or get rid of Lynch and Peters.
Right.
And they moved Daddy, but Daddy was so hurt because when they took him out of there, the inmates got mad at Daddy, telling him, you know, you shouldn't leave us here. We still got to deal with these people. Why? And he said, clearly, it hurt him to his heart.
Right.
He said, but get your families involved.
Right.
And that's what we need. Not only are 2 million people in prison, we need at least one family member from each one of those incarcerated prisoners to step up and take a stand.
I think that's right. I think the humanizing of the families who are incarcerated, and especially in solitary, is the most important element because this government and each state wants to dehumanize all of the people who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So your voices humanizing people one by one are so critical.
It makes a difference,
it does.
I can tell you, at SCI Green, over 20 young boys, young men in their 20s hung themselves there within a short time in solitary confinement. Daddy has been there for years, and Daddy called me and said, it's cold back here. They're keeping the air on. They moved me to this cold area to find out what's going on. Well, the superintendent assistant explained to me that, Teresa, we're revamping. Don't go to the governor on this one. We're going to move your dad back. We're revamping the heating system. And I said, why? He said, oh, a guy hung himself here. I said, oh, I didn't know. I said, let me look that up. Come to find out, it was more almost 20 guys in their 20s that could not take solitary confinement for just like a couple of weeks or a couple of months. And Daddy was constantly yelling to the guys what to do when he said they come in strolling down the solitary unit. And he's yelling to them how to keep your wheels turning. You got to read. Don't give up. And he said, next thing you know, they're not strolling anymore. They're walking like zombies. They done been medicated. They're losing it mentally, or either they end up killing themselves. But see, you don't hear that. I hadn't heard all those guys that killed themselves until I went down to our main library here in Philadelphia and dug up the microfilms. So it's devastating because not only are we losing people mentally, people are losing their lives in these type of units.
Teresa, the movement depends on people like you. We are so impressed with the work that you've been doing, and we need you to stay strong. Everyone behind bars in that state is relying on you as a role model.
Very much so. And we have organizations here that today, the Decarceration is a new group who's trying to stop $600 million to expand greater for prison. They're having a big rally today. I'm going to be there. I'm going to speak. And we know that $600 million could go in mental health services, ex-offender programs, education, but they're trying to expand SCI greater for prison. So there are people fighting on all levels, and this prison bubble is going to burst. It's going to end. Oh, we're going to make sure that.
That's right.
We just got to stand strong and keep up the fight. And, you know, they don't, and educate our youth. We have this thing going on in Philadelphia where they're calling the youth flash mobs. But I've talked to these kids, and they're saying, we're not a flash mob. We just didn't have anything to do. And other kids came in and took advantage of the situation and started robbing people, but that wasn't their goal. So they had to label these kids as flash mobs, make them think they're something that they're not, because they don't want London bridges falling down, you know what I mean? And ain't a damn thing fair if these youth wake up and realize what's going on. It will be like Egypt and Libya, and it'd be like London.
And we need that in your state especially. We're hoping to have you back on in a few months to continue to talk about progress in drawing attention to the plight of those people in solitary in Pennsylvania.
No problem.
And give our best to your father.
I definitely will. I'm here, and anytime you need me, I'm here. And we must remember it's not just about my dad. We have people like Jerome Coffey, who has been in solitary.
Andre Jacobs.
Population.
Right.
Right. And now he's in a situation that he can't get out of. And it all started from this restricted housing unit. So I'm fighting on all levels. And I'm not going to give up. I'm not.
Don't give up, Teresa. We need you. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
And I thank you.
Okay. Big hug to you.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
So I went to the governor's office 3 times because, you know, 1 time don't mean anything. It's the same thing like when our people march nowadays and we march and we get in the street. You really just can't do 1 march. You really just got to keep going and going and going.
That's right.
Back. And same thing like what happened in Wisconsin. I had even told my dad, I'm going to get a tent and set up in front of, he said, no. They may lock you up. I need you on the outside. He said, you know, you went up there already. I said, yeah. He said, you just got to keep going. Not only are 2 million people in prison, we need at least 1 family member from each one of those incarcerated prisoners to step up and take a stand.
I think that's right. I think the humanizing of the families who are incarcerated, and especially in solitary, is the most important element, because this government and each state wants to dehumanize all of the people who are incarcerated. So your voices humanizing people one by one are so critical.
It makes a difference.
It
and
does.
I can tell you, at SCI Green, over 20 young boys, young men in their 20s hung themselves there.